The Book of Wands,
Chapter 1, Niles Abercrombie. I met Frank Zappa one Denver summer night in 1973. My high school buddy Scott Limburger and I had snuck into the KFML FM radio station building where Frank was giving an interview before his concert that evening. He had been my hero for years. I worshipped him as a composer and a cultural rebel. We first peered at him through the glass studio window inside, and then accosted him on his way out. I'll always remember the very first words that he spoke to me. He said,
"Hold on a second. I have to go to the bathroom."
When he returned, Frank was polite and cordial. He gave me one single bit of advice, along with his ballpoint pen autograph on the outside of a crinkled used envelope that I stuffed into my pocket, the only scrap of paper I had at hand at the moment. He said,
"Remember, you are employed and working for the Muse."
My name is Niles Abercrombie. I've taught over 30,000 music lessons in my life to an uncounted number of pupils, with a few students thrown in. Very few. I've taught an even select fewer of those to use wands. I'm a university-trained musician with a teaching certificate in music education from the state of Colorado, United States of America, Earth, Solar System, Milky Way Galaxy, Universe 14 RCB, Sector 42, Reality Phase 9. I earned this certificate many, many years ago. I've long outgrown it, and I let it expire and die of natural causes 5 short years after it arrived in my mailbox. It came in a big white envelope packed along with my diploma, as well as an application for car insurance. My teaching certificate and college diploma were mailed to me, since I had not received such documents ceremoniously in person, with a handshake and wearing the traditional cap and gown. Nor had I less ceremoniously obtained it either, as conceivably wearing mere plain jeans and sneakers with holes in each, the certificate slid through the opening of a bulletproof teller window inside the administration office building by a smiling cherubic clerk with a Hispanic surname. I opted for the much more informal U.S. postal mail delivery option. Less walking for me, same end result with all the pomp and pageantry. I'm not big on ceremony. In college, I learned how to play every band instrument that John Philip Sousa wrote an arrangement for. I also learned how to toot and pluck on every instrument used in a modern-day symphonic orchestra, those instruments that I already had not taught myself to play out of curiosity growing up. I was always very interested in music and doing things with my hands, but I wasn't very interested in institutions or tradition per se. It's no coincidence that the same dexterity applied to instruments helps in the channeling of energy through an assortment of unusual tools. However, there is presently no college course on the proper employment of such tools, nor is there any diploma associated with this skill. I earn my extracurricular skill without documentation or accreditation. I learn the how-to of wands directly from studying the only real source of literature I know of on the subject, and from trial and error. As I've come to learn, wand technique greatly relies on the underlying fundamental principles that I learned from the one person who was responsible for allowing me to get my hands on a copy of such a textbook on the subject. This person, almost certainly a wand practitioner himself during his life, was considered by the general public as wildly eccentric, at the very least, if not outright out of his mind. Indeed, my first direct knowledge of unusual tools and how they work came as a result of spending an awful lot of time with a fellow that most people thought was just some crazy old guy living in a shack up in the mountains. High up in a remote forest near the Colorado Continental Divide lived and worked the founder and director of the Dormant Brain Research and Development Laboratory, D.A.T. Stingo, or as we called him, Distingo, or even simpler, Stingo. I've always found that a person's name reveals something about their character, and this seems to be the case with everyone that's played a significant role in this story. In his case, Stingo was a tough professor and teacher. He didn't mess around. He could give you the most powerful injection of truth and wisdom of anyone I'd ever met, as well as a huge shot of inspiration and energy. But he also had a sharp bite if you made the fatal mistake of taking him for a fool. You could get stung badly, and you wouldn't forget. Up until now, his involvement with Wands has remained a complete secret to nearly every one of his students and subjects who passed through the stone gate to his pristine wilderness facility. In all respects, it was already a place off the most unbeaten track. For him to further admit to utilizing Wands would have pushed his already teetering reputation even further off-center and completely off the precipice of doubtful acceptance. Had Stingo revealed his interest in knowledge, much less professed a use of Wands, he would have certainly been considered a complete lunatic by all, including his most ardent supporters. So, thus, it went unadvertised to his grave. The main work of Stingo's behavior lab was teaching people the ins and outs of how their mind motor worked, learned in the atmosphere of nature unspoiled. You see, Stingo wanted to save the world, but one person at a time. He felt that the world was a mess because most people had a mess of a brain. Multiply a messy brain by billions of brain owners, and you get a messy and doomed planet. If you can save one brain, that brain can save another. Each one, teach one, he would say. And with that, a geometric progression would begin.
Save one soul, and you save the universe, an ancient script echoed from the past.
My self-imposed job was to see if I could save myself, for a start. If you manage to hear about and actually find the Dormant Brain Lab and its director caretaker, you might sign up for a 6-week Brain in Nature course. You would camp out for weeks on end, sleep on hard stone-covered ground in your self-made lean-to shelter, and at the end of the summer, you'd have enough knowledge of how the human brain works to teach a university crash course on the subject. Then, you'd go home. To all of the hundreds of people who found their way to that backwoods institute and completed the course, brain training would remain their only impression of what Stingo and his place was all about. But quite out of view, hidden far off the main trail proper, was a key to tools that would surely land anyone locked admission into the funny farm if they dared speak of it in public. It was here where I first learned of
the Book of Wands.
Surely, no other former participants of the Brain Lab will confirm what I'm about to reveal, mainly because they just weren't in on this most secretive of Stingo's secrets. They all split once they got from him what they wanted and what they expected to get.
"Once a student pops his frontal lobes," Stingo often remarked, "I never see him again."
I hung around years after everyone else had gone home to feed their goldfish. As it turned out, something else turned up on the end of my line. During his life, Stingo didn't want to jeopardize the rest of his work and his already counterculture reputation by even wilder claims, now set forth in my own account here. I can afford such a personal risk, as I already have a steady and permanent income selling thousands of battery-operated pet nail trimmers on eBay each month under a completely different name. So, let us proceed. Chapter 2. The Niles Abercrombie School of Music and Other Stuff. My wand exposure and education began as early as I can remember, although I didn't realize, nor was I told, that I was obtaining such instruction indirectly or otherwise until far later on. My grandma gave me my first wand for my 6th birthday. It came attached to a long-playing phonograph record entitled Conduct Your Own Orchestra. It was a long black plastic baton, and the idea was that as you listened to orchestral favorites on the record player, you'd wave your baton along with the music. This was rudimentary travel, in that I was actually glimpsing my own true future. In fact, before I was 21 years of age, I was leading an orchestra, at least in conducting class at the university. Additionally, I would lead numerous other musical ensembles throughout my life. I rather doubt if any other user of that album and the wand that came with it actually shared a similar fortune. Of course, the record absolutely did not advertise the stick as a wand for travel, but rather supplied the would-be conductor with more regular expectations and directions for use. Using a wand as a wand is almost universally unadvertised as such. Understandably, claims one would make of such an activity would lead others to the perception that one has lost all his marbles. But I diverge. I refused to go to my university graduation, held early one summer Saturday morning, because I felt that achieving my higher education had already robbed me of enough of my own personal time. I had already missed hundreds of hours of early weekend Bugs Bunny cartoons during my youth because of Saturday morning religious school that my parents forced me to attend. Enough was enough already. Speaking of religious school, I have never been particularly interested in religion either, with the possible exception of Taoism. Now, that is clearly a pretty feeble excuse for an institutional belief system, but about as close to religion as I will ever voluntarily wander. You know what those Taoists say.
The way is not hard for those who have no preferences.
Well now, that's what I call religion. When I graduated from college, I immediately took a position as a substitute music teacher in the Denver Public Schools. That lasted for exactly one semester before I completely dropped out of classroom teaching. I had begun drinking a half gallon of coffee a day just to stay awake in class from the lack of creative stimulation inside my own head. I drank other potions to calm me down, both on the way home and additionally after arriving home. My nerves were ritually being fried by junior high schoolers bouncing off the walls inside the hallowed and revered walled institution known as school. Being that necessity is the mother invention, and more on those mothers later, and that my own survival seemed very necessary to me, I soon learned that I could make a perfectly comfortable living by inventing my own school, teaching music one person at a time at in-home private music lessons. Thus, the Niles Abercrombie School of Music, Art, and Other Stuff helped me to dodge brain atrophy and or putting my nervous system at possible fatal risk from overexposure to large numbers of wildly enthusiastic elementary, middle, and high school pupils. Not that such public school classrooms are filled so much with students wildly enthusiastic about music, but more accurately, are typically filled with pupils enthusiastic about being wild. Speaking of students and pupils, one thing I do remember from my own middle school training, or at very least I continue to hallucinate, is that the difference between a pupil and a student is that a student studies, and a pupil simply watches. It's easy to remember the differences between those two if you remember that a pupil is nothing but a hole that sucks in light. The same classroom may be filled with 30 or more pairs of pupils, but may easily and simultaneously have zero students in it. As I've said, necessity is the mother of invention, and so for me, it was necessary to make a living with music without losing my mind. I do, however, continue to be accused of already having met that fate. So it goes. Speaking of mother, when I was in the sixth grade, I earned my first few fistful of dollars self-employed, walking door to door in my neighborhood selling my own original pastel sketches. This was indeed chalk wands at work, making dollars in this most innocent manner. I shocked my mother, herself a schoolteacher, when she found out how I'd spent my afternoon mixing adolescent capitalism with crayons. My mother's now 90, and she still can't believe, nor does she entirely approve of the idea, that I actually make my living as a self-employed artist of any type. Like I said, I let my teaching certificate expire because I never again wanted to voluntarily or otherwise set foot in a band room after an indoor winter and spring spent trying to wrestle order out of hundreds of entropy-intent adolescent and younger bipedal hominids wielding drums, cymbals, horns, loud reed instruments, catgut strung boxes, and other civilized instruments of cacophony. I continue to get my car insurance through my college, however, so my college education was not entirely wasted. My mother had tried her best to sculpt me in her own image as a dedicated public school servant, but it was ultimately an exercise in futility for her part. My heart had been guided by another mother throughout my teenage years, i.e., I had grown up listening to the decadent and rebellious strains of Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, as well as giving equal time listening and studying Captain Beefheart and his magic band. These were Dadaists with a tune. Years after I had fled the public schools, Mom had still tried to convince me to keep my school teaching certificate valid.
"You never know when you want to teach in the schools again," she told me over and over.
I temporarily succumbed, and as I sat in the Colorado Teaching Certificate Renewal Study Seminar held at the Stapleton Airport Sheridan Hotel Conference Center, my mind kept drifting back to the strains of Zappa compositions such as "Who Are the Brain Police?" and "You're Probably Wondering Why I'm Here." At the lunch break, sitting in a large cafeteria with 100 or so soon-to-be recertified, refried public servants, I pondered my future in a just-emptied vanilla pudding cup that was part of our collective lunch break. I wondered how many more pudding cups I would stare blankly into and how many more noisy lunchroom cafeterias in the years to come. I took a quick, deep breath and silently made a break for my car out in the parking lot, forever away from recertification, as if I were escaping from the penitentiary and a life sentence. I never looked back. My resourcefulness in creating a career for myself as a private music teacher has had many distinct advantages over being employed by the state, not the least of which is that I get to stay home all day and spend quality time with my dogs, Irfie and Chloe, and practice with my sticks, wands, and other useful tools of travel. Irfie and Chloe are sleeping next to me on the couch right now as I write this. Yes, indeed, you are now ingesting the thoughts of a person who, while transcribing this at his particular longitude, latitude, and other dimensions and coordinates of time, space, and abstract thought, is sitting on a comfy three-cushion sofa with a semi-abstract Southwestern Native American-inspired geometrical designs imprinted on the fabric. Self-determination also allows this person to type at his own whim day or night, with nary a care of waking up in time to join the mad rat race at 7 a.m. Next to him are two snoring and dreaming twin sibling West Highland White Terriers, each in their own, or perhaps other intersecting dog dream universes. They never dropped out of the rat race because they never joined it to begin with. They have, contrary-wise, chased smaller rodents across the kitchen floor. Fortunately, my home has largely been rat-free, albeit not free of their smaller and cuter cousins. I hesitate to inform my companions that they have never actually caught a single mouse in their lives. Oh, wait, I take that back. One of them, actually, had deposited a big, fat, gray mouse at the foot of my bed just a couple of months ago. That's probably why this particular rodent got caught in the first place. Too chubby to run away fast enough. Anyway, Erfy is the big brother, Chloe the little sister. As I engage in interspecies telecommunication, tickling my amygdala forward and my frontal lobes on, I perceive the internal and non-corporal activities inside these somewhat smaller canine craniums. Erfy, dreaming of a giant bowl, a white ceramic bowl decorated with colorful yellow flowers and blueberry and strawberry designs. It overflows with endless crunchy peanut butter and molasses dog biscuits. Crunch, crunch, crunch. Chloe, running through a wonderfully green hilly meadow, sun shining, birds twirping, butterflies dancing, clouds drifting, dandelion puffs riding on the wind. She runs to the top of the hill, wagging her tail. And at the top of the hill, she comes upon a giant bowl of endless crunchy peanut butter and molasses doggy cookies. Crunch, crunch, crunch. I have no doubt at all who is the more intelligent of creatures between humans and canines. Despite the greater relative volume of the human brain, I humbly bow at the simple wisdom and generosity of my furry family members. Less is far more.
Chapter 3.1415926, The First Jar. You wouldn't know it by looking, but months and months have gone by since I last tap-danced my fingers on my laptop keyboard from 2 pages ago, with the intention of notating this written history for any such person as yourself to eavesdrop upon. Of course, you, my attentive listener, are indeed there. If a tree falls over in the forest and no squirrel or worm is there to hear it, does a worm have ears anyway? It does not, in fact, make a noise. Naturally, the converse is also true. If you weren't there to comprehend my descriptions, then, of course you are, because you are, gosh, I'm getting lost myself. Okay, then. Anyway, I've been putting most of this off for nearly a year now, but I can no longer delay the inevitable. Like Chloe barking and scratching at the back door wanting to come inside, the need for this written record has been making its presence ever more intense as each week passes. Certainly, you must know what I mean. You've woken up early in the morning, perhaps only half out of a dream, hearing that persistent voice when you are still in bed, still in your wrinkled and sweaty pajamas, and there is no place left to run away to. Your own conscience is staring at you from inside your skull and in no uncertain terms laying down the law. There is not enough room under your bed to hide away to. You know what lies ahead for you in the upcoming daylight. You cannot pull the covers up over your head any further than you already have. In my case, I no longer have any doubt at all that my unfinished task must be completed, and that it is now more than ever immediately at hand. It is certain that I will be traveling a great distance this time, and from all indications, my furthest distance yet in one fell swoop. For one aspect of this journey that I will share with you in this account, a tool that I will come to rely on, using it in the most ordinary fashion, my wand used for typing here, is of the complex variety, a portable alphabetic keyboard. Scoffed upon by purists, the portable keyboard is a very distant cousin to simple wands, such as pencils and brushes. Of course, it's an even more distant relative to the archetypal and classic mythical tool, the one that non-practitioners always think of when you mention the word magic, what is properly called a baton. Commonly referred to as a wand in the fictional literature, you know, Merlin waves his magic stick, hocus pocus, presto chango, that is a baton. They work, but not in that fairy tale fashion. You may shoo away a couple of mosquitoes by waving your baton around, but traveling with it takes a bit more finesse than that. Besides that, truly learn wands, and you realize that wand batons barely scratch the surface. As for keyboards, these are in another subcategory altogether, belonging to complex tools such as mechanical pencils and spring-loaded ballpoint pens. And even then, keyboards have branched off into their own sub-sub-category onto a remote limb of the unusual tools tree and a very long stretch of evolution. Some practitioners continue to vehemently deny the inclusion of any kind of keyboard into the family of extendio humerus. Extendio humerus, of course, refers to unusual tools that you utilize with an extended forearm. Obviously, unlike most other wands, a keyboard does not resemble a stick or pole of any type. But then, neither do cameras, pendulums, watches, or cards, and these tools have long garnered fair inclusion into this family of unusual implements. The fact is that you use a portable keyboard with a relatively extended arm, although usually not completely straight as a baseball bat, but away from your body like any other wand. Naturally, keyboard usage can produce the most mundane and ordinary results, like typing a letter or sending an email. But undeniably, in the hands of a trained and experienced master, like any other wand, you can use a decent keyboard to more or less figuratively travel to the sun and back, or for that matter, only hop around the block if that's all you desire. The idea of using a manual typewriter as a wand originally caused incredible disbelief and protest among seasoned travelers. That lasted until word finally got around that one didn't pick up a typewriter and wave it around like a baton or blow on it like a clarinet, as many unsuccessfully tried to do. Manual typewriters finally caught on and things quieted down at last, at least for a while. This is similar to the kind of resistance that the earth is not flat idea initially met. Then, of course, came electric typewriters. I'm still not sure of those myself, because anytime you are plugged into the wall, there are issues. It restricts your movement severely. You can trip and hurt your ankle. You can unplug yourself if you're not careful, and then everything will certainly and immediately grind to a sudden and disturbing halt. You may find yourself stuck face to face with a walking catfish on some swampy beach and without an exit. Personally, I've never had much luck with cords. Generally, I avoid corded appliances altogether, except for my electric guitars. You won't even find a blender in my house. Not that a blender could ever conceivably qualify as a wand. That's stupid. Now, of course, some travelers are moaning about laptop computer keyboards, and you would think it was the end of the world. Sure, trying to use a desktop computer as a wand, that's ridiculous. Even if you could wave it around, you are sure to sprain something. But even with a cheap laptop keyboard, there's no denying that you can get truly hardcore traveling done, if you know how to handle it. Of course, regarding keyboards, some people who know absolutely nothing about travel will completely get the wrong idea and think that the words you hammer out with a keyboard allow you to travel with your imagination.
Ego tibi gratias maximas agod.
Gosh, how absurd. I could only imagine an adult would think of that one. If you have actually traveled somewhere, you don't have to imagine anything. You see it all with your own real eyeballs. And then, of course, there are those portable musical keyboards. They work too, but that's something altogether different. Alphabetic keyboards are one thing, and sonic keyboards are another entirely. My first real inkling of a keyboard serving as a wand, of course, came directly from the person who was both a traveler and my brain teacher. I saw him using his typewriter constantly, but it was years before he ever let on even slightly what he was doing with the thing when nobody was watching. It wasn't until after he died that it hit me like the proverbial bolt from the blue what he was actually up to. But that is a story I will put off for just a short time, or at least until you turn enough pages. So, anyway, here we are. You are my passenger. My electronic pen is in my hand, my vehicle key, my spaceship launch code. Buckle up. Do not leave your seat until the no smoking sign vaporizes. I have general ideas about my destination, and such course images are my inspiration and fuel. I will leave the delectable details to remain as a pleasant adventure and surprise, for this is both desirable and unavoidable, as on any journey. Where this will all lead, I surely have no exact and complete idea, although I am certain everything will be quite different, or at least as different as peach jam is different from chocolate sardines. Here we go now, leaving the land of smelly fish to land upon more fragrant shores. My own boredom with things as they are has set in, and escape is a great motivator. The silver lining of misery is the encouragement of change. Time to move on and make a quantum leap off these pages. We will travel together, myself and whoever hitchhikes along. That looks like you at the moment. I was all set to live the perfect life, or as a cocky, independent 27-year-old, so I thought so, keeping my deepest fears under wraps. I was then living on my own in a little claustrophobic apartment in a rectangular brick 6-unit building smack dab in the middle of Denver, Colorado. My apartment was one of hundreds of square, nondescript buildings located on an endless urban crisscross grid of streets that had about as much personality as a screen door screen. But then my life, at least on the surface, was less generic than most. Handsome, in my opinion, confident, healthy, I was additionally self-employed and running my own small stable of willing piano and guitar students. Really, my ex-girlfriend had said that I was indeed very handsome. That is, before she broke up with me for being too short. When I dropped out of teaching in the public schools and first attempted being my own boss via the NASOMEOS, the Niles Abercrombie School of Music, Art, and Other Stuff, It didn't take very long to accumulate enough kid music students to make my rent and vegetarian hot dog buns each month. Within 14 days of getting my first two regularly paying students, I had 16 more steady customers clamoring to have lessons every week. Word got around the neighborhood pretty fast that here was an opportunity to entertain the kids that wouldn't require even more schlepping them around after school. Like wildfire, news spread that there was this fellow, me, who would come and teach Junior and Missy at-home music lessons right in the convenience of one's own basement rec room every week, and Mom could watch her afternoon soaps completely uninterrupted, or whatever it is that moms do after school. But in spite of my modest early business success, things were really not going as smooth as banana cream pie, despite the pretensions dictated by my young male ego. In reality, my future outlook and my self-assurance was as thin-skinned as same banana, pre-pie-fied. For one, despite my best efforts, I had made a habit of striking out in the romance department. My latest love disaster was with Sarah Yogurt, a more than lovely graduate of Vassar, whom I had met at yoga class. She made her living making gorgeous white porcelain functional pottery. Alas, before long, her potter studio trash can of discarded broken cups and saucers was soon joined by the fragments of my broken heart. Of course, for any young person, sheer hormone level in the bloodstream dictate that one's love life sits high on the pedestal of positive self-esteem. Unfortunately, the tonality of amore for Niles had been set long before. For starters, as early as in the sixth grade, with knees shaking, I had one day miraculously managed to gather up enough courage to phone the object of my unrequited desire at the time, little cute elfin Cassie Boggs. She sat dolefully two rows over from me every day in Mr. Watson's homeroom class. I figured my chances with her were ripe for the plucking. Age 12 years old, I picked up our kitchen's demure princess model wall phone, paused for a minute, took a breath, and dialed.
Hello?
She answered.
Hello, Cassie?
Yes?
This is Niles.
Niles?
Niles Abercrombie.
My mother walked into the kitchen, and I immediately froze solid. Then I dropped the phone. Eventually, I heard this distant voice in the ether as I waited for my mother to walk past into the laundry room.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
What was that?
Hello, Cassie? Are you still there?
Niles?
I was wondering if you would like to go to the shopping center with me on Saturday.
I figured this was a good place to start for my first romantic escapade. First, we would go look through the front window of the barber shop where I got my hair cut one Saturday each month. Then, it would be on to the drugstore, where we might peruse the greeting cards and additionally see if Epsom salts might be on sale. Then, we would perhaps conclude our wonderful shopping center afternoon together by strolling past Big Wheel Car and Truck Tires and Shops. However, thereupon in my kitchen was dead silence for what seemed an eternity. According to Einstein's special theory of relativity, if you are in a rocket ship moving away from Earth at nearly the speed of light, time stands still. I think it is the same if you are on a phone call calling up a girl for your first date. I could barely breathe. Then the answer came.
No, I can't. I have to do something. I have to get something for my brother's turtle cage. Sorry!
My first ruby-red, luscious Adam's apple of desire had fallen from the tree. and it had a worm in it. Cassie's response on that fateful prepubescent afternoon would set the pattern to similar quixotic proposals for many years to come. Sarah Yogurt made me keenly aware that this had persisted well into my 27th year, cast in stone. Pottery, that is. And then there was my career. My ambitions of becoming a famous and respected avant-garde composer and progressive jazz musician were stuck on flypaper. I was stranded in Nowheresville, man. I was spinning the wheels of self-expression on the gravel roads of Cowtown, USA, the home of the National Western Stock Show, Denver, Colorado. Yippee-ki-yay! After my heroes Frank Zappa and Don Van Fleet, I had been writing modern-sounding compositions and giving them such poetic titles such as Potato Chip Roundup and Farts a Lot. I was convinced that these were immortal sonic creations, but nobody was jumping on board my musical bandwagon train. In Southern California, I might have met a better reception, but here, smack dab between Wichita and Salt Lake City, in colorful, culturally backward Colorado, someone came up to me after one of my self-promoted concerts and suggested, "You guys would be great if you just played some real music." And that comment came from one of my best friends. I had magnificent dreams, as does every young person. But did I know how to make those glorious dreams come true? Heck no. I was lost. High school had barely prepared me to tie my own shoes. College had shown me how to zip up my pants, but not much more. And my parents, bless them, with all their honest love and guidance, still hadn't completely prepared me for the all-important skill of finding my own way. Not entirely. I don't know if any parents could. I needed my idea spark plugs reconnected. I needed a no-fool injection. I needed a change of under-awareness. I needed something. In the summer of 1982, one evening, it came in the form of a documentary movie shown on my TV. I had been bored out of my skull late one Saturday night, barely propping myself up in bed on my stomach, chin in one hand, remote control in the other. I was endlessly channel surfing one station after another. Eventually, I took a bathroom break at the top of the hour, got a drink of water direct from the bathroom sink faucet, returned to bed, plopped myself back down, then continued as before. Then, I saw him. I had clicked forward to a channel coming out of a little independent 19-watt PBS station situated in a Quonset hut 20 miles outside of town. I adjusted my rabbit ears and tried to get rid of as much of the furry static as I could. There, on my TV set, was a picture, a moving picture, a gloriously low-budget, faded, color, 16-millimeter documentary film picture.
Are you there? Hello, we are here. Love, 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 are you there? Love, 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 love.
There, in the center of the screen, sat this fellow, about 50 years old, on a log in the middle of the woods. His hair was long and nearly shoulders length. His belly button hung leisurely over the elastic band of his shorts. He wore a beard on one end, and he was wearing shorts on the other. And by that I mean boxer shorts. And that was all. No shirt, no shoes. But here on Educational PBS, he was supplying a service. His hands held a 1 gallon bell jar. Later, I would discover how important all kinds of jars would be in the world of wand manipulation. But then, he held the kind of jar that you see in a Frankenstein movie containing a brain. And that's exactly what I saw. In this jar was indeed a brain. and this half-naked fellow was pulling this brain out of the jar, dripping wet with, I presume, formaldehyde. Heidi, heidi, ho! The brain momentarily slipped from his grip and tried to hide back inside the safety of the jar. Plop, plop, no fizz. However, the man persisted to wrangle this creature out of its container, and moments later he proudly held up the brain at eye level. The bearded one slowly turned it to display it proudly from all 360 degrees.
"This,"
he said slowly, deliberately, and very grandly,
"is the center of the universe."
You've been listening to The Book of Wands with Neil Slade, featuring the music of Fred Poindexter and Neil Slade.